Welcome to the Wonder Women Tech Show, where we highlight, celebrate, and amplify global leaders who are creating impact. We humanize our role models and curate a culture of vulnerability and belonging. This is a show designed to innovate, empower, and ignite. I'm your host, Lisa Mae Brunson. Innovators, it's Lisa Mae Brunson with the Wonder Women Tech Show. And today's guest is someone who inspires all of us to reimagine everything we think we know about the Home Depot as our favorite home improvement company. They're also a technology company. So Angie Brown is Vice President of Technology at the Home Depot. She and her team lead the merchandising development organization, technology enablement functions, and enterprise user experience. Prior to her current position, Angie served as Vice President of Technology Stores, where she led the company's in-store technology systems. During this time, Angie and her team reimagined several experiences, such as self-checkout, and implemented the order management system, which powers the Home Depot's interconnected retail offerings. Angie began her career at the Home Depot in 1998 as an entry-level software developer and has held roles of increasing responsibility since that time. She earned a degree in Management Information Systems from the University of Georgia and has completed Harvard University's Authentic Leader Development Program and Carnegie Mellon Heinz College's CIO Certificate Program. Angie serves as the VP Advisor for Women's Link, Home Depot's internal resource group dedicated to supporting female associates to grow their careers. And Angie also serves on the board of Junior Achievement of Georgia and Technology Association of Georgia. And when she's not making technology magic, Angie enjoys spending time with her husband and two daughters. Welcome to the show, Angie.
Thank you so much for having me. It's awesome to be with you today.
I love it. Well, first of all, I have to just say my mind was blown when I learned you've been part of the technology division for the Home Depot since 1998. I don't think most of us even know that such a division exists.
It is so funny to think about because you're exactly right. A lot of times technology is not the first thing you think of when you think of Home Depot. And it's also so unusual for somebody to have spent a 23-year career in technology at one place. So I'm kind of an anomaly on a few fronts.
Yeah, I'm so excited. And before we get into those details and learn about what an anomaly you are, I would love to learn more about your roots. Because you were born and raised in Georgia and you're still there. So could you take us back to your childhood and share what was that was like for you?
Absolutely. I'll probably even go a little bit further back than just my childhood and say that my parents landed in Augusta just a few short months before I was born. My family roots are in the Southeast. My parents had both met in high school in Tennessee, and then my father had moved around some, taking a few different jobs with places prior to them landing in Augusta. And when they landed there, like I said, I was born a few months later, and I have, we lived in the same house until I was 16 years old. So my early childhood was really kind of devoid of change. I drove the same road to go to the same grocery store for, you know, a good decade and a half growing up. And, it was a suburb of Augusta. It was actually called Martinez. And it, when you look at it now, it's so funny because there was one high school in town, and that area of Georgia has seen a tremendous amount of growth, and the same area is probably served by, man, four or five high schools now. So, but it was a little bit of a simpler time in my early education, and it definitely had a small town feel to it.
It's hard for me to fathom, you know, living in California now, what such a childhood looks like. But, you know, I grew up in New Mexico, so we also kind of had like the same routine growing up. But I imagine in Georgia, the landscape is so much different. And there has to be something said for, you know, that constant, you know, experience of you know, having a level of comfort there. Were you the oldest of the children, or what did that look like with your siblings?
I am actually the youngest. I have one sibling. My brother is 10 years older than I am. So that in and of itself carries a number of jokes. My parents, we share the same biological parents, and my parents say that, oh no, Angie, you weren't a surprise. We just wanted you 8 years earlier. So my brother and I, though, you can imagine being 10 years apart, what that's like. In a lot of ways, we grew up as only children. We're very close now, but we had to hit the same life stage. And that wasn't happening when I was 8 years old and he was 18 and a freshman in college. Yeah. You know, it was that's my situation from a sibling perspective. He was probably more protective than my dad was in a lot of ways. so definitely had the older brother kind of looking over my shoulder. But like I said, we're actually very close once I got out of college, once I got married, once I settled down and started a family. Then we don't feel 10 years apart anymore by any means.
Because now we're both adults, responsible.
Exactly.
Adults.
Exactly.
What were some of your earliest influences that shaped your early education and your interests?
If I think back to my grandparents, I think my grandparents influenced me a lot, and my mom did as well. So my grandfathers both worked for the exact same company. It was Aluminum Company of America, Alcoa. And one of my grandfathers was basically a factory foreman, and one of my grandfathers was the head of operations for Australia. So they had very different kind of lives, but both of them were involved in business and the business of Alcoa in very different ways. And so I was always influenced by seeing them work for these big companies. And, you know, I was always kind of intrigued by how they could both work for the same company and have, you know, very different roles and responsibilities and things like that. And I fell in love kind of with just business through them. And I know that sounds maybe a little bit odd, but true. And then my mother was really an influence because she dropped out of college to put my dad through school. So they were married and they needed income. And so she was very heavy on me receiving an education through a 4-year degree program because she, I think in some ways, you know, I don't know if regretted is the right word, but that was an opportunity she didn't have and she wanted to make sure that I did. And so those were two, I think, big influences in my early childhood and just watching them in, quote, the world of business, whatever that may look like, and then also an underscoring of education.
So you really carried those traits with you to inspire you to go into business one day or to at least be in a company is what I'm getting.
Yes, definitely so. And I knew that I loved math. If I was like in middle school and things like that, and I reflected on that time period, I knew I loved math. I knew I loved business. And so I joke, I probably am one of the few people that in middle school dreamed of being an accountant. But I thought that was the only way that you matched the two. Like, if you loved solving math problems and you loved companies, then you were an accountant. Like, that's what you did. And so, yeah, that was my first dream that I remember, was nothing against all the fabulous accountants in the world. We need them day in and day out. But that was my first dream, was, of all things, to be an accountant. So
when did you realize, like, actually, I don't have to just be an accountant. I could do other things.
You know, hopefully I don't, this isn't an intelligence test that I failed, but I would tell you that honestly, it was probably college that my aperture got opened. And to provide a little context to that, and this is one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about STEAM education, is that that wasn't even a phrase when I was, you know, growing up. This concept of STEAM and engineering and arts and math, you know, and how those can turn into different careers, you know, you'd have to fact check me here, but I don't think the STEM acronym was even popular or well established until like the late 90s, right as I was coming out of college. It definitely wasn't when, you know, I was in middle school. But it took me getting to college and being in an environment that really demonstrated all of the different kind of pathways to careers, and, you know, walking the campus of the School of Business and seeing, you know, risk management and, you know, real estate and accounting and management information systems and all of these different things kind of in one place, honestly.
So what did your educational track look like? And when did you know that you wanted to delve into the technology sector?
So my education track, like, I think I knew from a pretty decently early age, I would say like middle school, that I loved math and I really, really liked business. And so I thought at that age, as whatever that is, 13-year-old, that the way forward then was for me to be an accountant. And literally, like, if you were to ask me, my 13-year-old self, what do you want to be when you grow up? I would say an accountant, because I loved business and I loved math. And I thought, this is how you come together. So everything from like middle school till truly probably my sophomore year in college, what college I went to, et cetera, was all driven by seeking to be an accountant. And it wasn't really until I got into college and I saw the campus and the School of Business and all of the different opportunities that I got open to more of an idea of software development or engineering or management information systems, whatever it is. Because when you think about it, when I was growing up, STEM wasn't an acronym. We didn't talk about STEM education, and we didn't talk about all the different ways you could apply a love of those things into a career. So it really took me getting into college to understand that.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting. Having been able to talk with so many amazing people on this show and at our conferences, to discover that a lot of times, once they're exposed to STEM and STEAM, that's when they get to shape their careers and their ideas around, you know, their path forward. Because it is true, when we're growing up, when I was in school, none of this was anywhere near, you know, presented as opportunities to me. It was, you're a teacher. I actually did, funnily enough, I did take some accounting classes, but I hate math. So you and I are on opposite ends of the spectrum, but I'm a science geek. I love, 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 love anything that has to do with the universe and biology. I was the first person to dissect things. So
awesome.
The first girl, like, raising my hand and asking to hold all the snakes, still am. But I would have never thought that that could be a career I could go in, because it just wasn't something that the teachers presented as opportunities for the girls.
Right. Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, for me too, it was just not having, like you said, not understanding all the different careers that were open. And nothing against my school or my high school or anything of that nature. I just don't feel like that we invested then like we do today, and making sure people know the possibilities that are out there in the workforce.
Yeah, that's so true. So many of us have had to go through the dreaded internships program. So can you share with us about your first internship experience?
Oh, you know what? I'm a horrible guest to answer this. I did not actually intern. Can you believe that? So I'll tell you what I did do. Instead, I worked for... So I got it when I was a junior in college. I was in a systems accounting class, and it was my systems accounting class when I realized that I liked the systems side more than I did the accounting side. And so I went into the Management Information Systems program and said, please help. I think I've spent 3 years or just about 3 years on the wrong path, and I need to do an about face. And by the way, I still want to graduate on time because there's this whole tuition thing that I don't want to keep on writing checks for. And yes. So one of the things that I did do from a summer perspective, though, is I spent my time being a teacher's assistant for one of the professors at the university in their entry-level software development classes. And so instead of doing an internship with like a third party or a school, a third party or a company or anything of that nature, I did work for the university and helped out one of the professors. And you know, that interview process wasn't too difficult because I was basically begging for anything I needed to do to graduate on time. So,
and did you graduate?
I did. All of my electives were upper level accounting classes, and that kind of stunk. But yes, I graduated on time. So,
what were some of the challenges you faced as you were getting your degree in management information systems? And how did you navigate through them? Did you have mentors?
The professor that I just mentioned that I ended up being a teacher's assistant for, I think, turned into a mentor for me. But I will tell you, this is actually one of the things that I kind of regret most about my early career is I did not understand the value of mentors. I did not seek people out. I did not ask for a lot of help. I did not... look at people's other experiences and try to, like I said, have conversations with them or learn from them. And it wasn't because I didn't feel like I could learn. I was too intimidated. Like, why would, they're not going to want to like have a conversation with me about that. Like, that was the narrative that went through my head constantly. So I was a lot of people are in technology. I was pretty introverted and, but did have confidence that I could figure it out. So some of the people that I talked to the most were probably my classmates that were in the curriculum at the same time as we were navigating what it was going to mean to turn this into a career and what it was going to look like. On the other side, and the options for careers, we kind of went through that together and weighed pros and cons of, did we want to go into a consulting firm? Did we really want to, code? Did we want to, kind of use some of our skills to do more like business analytics and things of that nature? And obviously, a lot of different companies came on campus and gave you insight into what it looked like to work for them, and that was a big asset. But I regret not having more formal mentors along the way and seeking out more insight, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I can identify with that myself. I didn't have any mentors, and I'm the oldest of five growing up and six total. And I sort of wish that I had pushed for that more growing up. I think being the oldest, I kind of was like, yeah, I could figure it out. But it doesn't really, go very well as you get older. So the importance of mentorship is just huge, huge.
Completely agree.
So you received your certification for Harvard University's Authentic Leader Development Program. So what are some of the building blocks of that program and the important takeaways that you have from that?
Yeah, that was a class that I did. It was, they do a multi-month program. program. I took the leadership development class, which was about authentic leadership development. So that was really, I'll tell you why I sought it out first. I've loved being with the same company for over two decades. I really have. And I look at it in a lot of ways as a phenomenal opportunity. But I've also always questioned what the world was like outside of the company that I worked for. And when I think about being the best, you know, employee I can be, I think having insight into the industry and into, you know, even leadership techniques, et cetera, that maybe we don't talk about day in, day out at the one place that I go to work to, you know, or used to physically go to work to, now virtually work for, you know, that was really what I sought out about that program. And I think that leadership is one of those things that as technologists, I don't know how much we talk about that it is a skill that you learn, just like technology being a skill that you learn. And by that time in my career, I was in director type roles, looking to move up to an officer position. And I really wanted to hone who I was as a leader, not the skill, you know, not the personas that maybe I'd been surrounded by, but who am I as a leader? And so that was the big draw for me on that program. And it was a fabulous introspection into that. One of the things that I loved about it, go back to the, I've lived, you know, in the same state my whole life. I lived on the same, you know, I went to the same grocery store for, you know, however many decades when I was growing up. You know, Harvard has such an international draw. So to be surrounded by not just people from different states, but people from different countries. And, yeah, you know, the work that they were doing, both, you know, in technology and just in leadership and what leadership meant in their industry and in, you know, their cultures as well. It was a fabulous experience, one, to gain empathy for others, and then two, to also really be, like I said, self-reflective on your brand and how knowing yourself and being authentic to yourself builds trust, you know, in leadership and as you work with your teammates, et cetera.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And I love the authentic leadership program. I think we all need to take one of those.
Especially when you're, you know, early in your career, you feel like there's a definition of, you know, what leadership means. And my role as the boss, in air quotes, means I should be doing X, Y, Z. And so this was just a terrific, you know, program that added a lot more clarity to leadership more than anything else.
Yeah, well, you know, what's really cool about your story is that you joined the Home Depot in 1998 as an entry-level software developer. So can you tell us more about your humble beginnings and the career path you took to get to where you are today?
Absolutely. So yeah, I joined in 1998, just like what you said, as an entry level developer. I spent about 2 weeks writing COBOL code, and then they said, "Hold on, we're going to start you on this thing called Java." And so, the very first systems that I worked on were in our HR systems, and it was, I mean, think about it. At that time, you applied for a job via paper. And so if you wanted to work at one of our local Home Depot stores, you drove to said Home Depot store, you walked in the front door, you asked to speak to somebody, and you filled out a paper application. And so I worked on systems that digitized that. I'm going to just repeat that sentence because I don't know if you heard that ping. But I worked on the systems that digitized that whole process. And in addition to how you apply for a job, it was then how managers would review the applicants in both internal and external, and then, you know, select candidates, and it started digitizing the entire HR process, which we had never had before. We used to, all of our stores across the country would fill out the paperwork then when you were hired and mail it to the office, and then they would key that in. So it was just, it's crazy to think about some of those things, but that was the environment when I started. Obviously, we've said the year a few times, 2 years prior to Y2K. So as soon as we got that HR system, it was all about, you know, are we going to, is everything going to be okay January 1, 2000? I never will forget, I slept under my desk on the night of Y2K. You know, basically we were all in there, but there was nothing going on. And so that's why I was sleeping. And so I was not the only one sleeping, but So
you didn't ring in the new year. You were sleeping under your desk preparing for this potential Y2K.
Exactly. It was like, get your rest now in case like tomorrow is, you know, a complete cluster and we're all running around like crazy. You know, we felt pretty good about things, but yeah. So that was Y2K, but I spent a few years in the HR area. And then really what was so cool about the job then is that technology was growing for Home Depot. For sure. And I got the opportunity to just work in a few different areas. The boss that I worked for, this goes back to the power relationships, he got reassigned a few times. And when he got reassigned, I found out I was getting reassigned. And, you know, he would kind of take a few right-hand people like into the next area to help, like, you know, get teams going, et cetera. And so I got the opportunity via, you know, that relationship and everything to go from the HR area to, like I said, the merchandising area into our first area into customer analytics, like way before our time. And it went over like a lead balloon. We were trying to figure out how to use customer demographics to drive our store assortment. And when I say it went over like a lead balloon, it's because we were just too early and the stores were like, you're doing what? Those were kind of the early years of my career, and I was just willing to go and do whatever. Like if I got tapped on the shoulder, hey, we need your help in X area, I was comfortable going even if I didn't know the area. I was comfortable going and learning and trying to help figure it out. And so I think that was a big kind of theme of the first couple of, you know, years of my career was, okay, sure. What do you want me to learn? All right, I'll try it. And not being afraid if I didn't know the answer. So
I call that like say yes and figure it out later. Like exactly. I'm known for that. I mean, when we first launched Wonder Woman Tech, I had no idea how to do a conference or go get sponsors or get speaker, like nothing. But I'm like, sure. Can you bring this to LA? Sure. So I get it. I mean, it really, there is something to be said for, obviously, I like how you positioned it. I felt comfortable saying yes. Like I felt comfortable knowing that I didn't know what I was doing. And that I think is a great starting point, is that you don't necessarily have to always know what you're doing, but be comfortable enough to give yourself permission to be daring.
You're exactly right. Now I should probably clarify, the first one or two times they tapped me on the shoulder, I was like, what? And you know, I had that fear in the pit of my stomach, but like once you do it once or twice where you realize I didn't know the answers coming in, but I was able to figure it out and there's, you know, people to help and et cetera, like that really is such a key lesson. And I think especially when we talk about women in technology, like there can be this undercurrent where you feel like you have to be the expert and, you know, to stand up for yourself, et cetera. But really what you need more than anything is that beginner's mindset, willing to go learn, willing to collaborate. And so the sooner, you know, you kind of feel comfortable with, no, that really is what you need more than being the expert. I think it settles a lot of nerves, if you will, and opens a lot of opportunities up.
Well, you're a great case study for really, I mean, working from the bottom to the top. I mean, now you are the vice president of technology. So I'd love to shadow you for a day. What are your day-to-day responsibilities?
All right. So no surprise, I would say they're all spent in front of a camera right now. We are still remote. And so even so, as much as I love,
I'm qualified now. What's next?
Exactly. In fact, I would argue you're probably more qualified on the AV side of things. You know, I have struggled to get this set up today. So, so a lot of time spent talking with people, though, like, you know, set the technology aside. In addition to the merchandising organization, I actually have two other areas that are, one's straightforward to explain and one's a little bit hard to explain. I assumed responsibility for our enterprise user experience discipline a few months ago. And so that's also, in addition to having a development organization, the actual software engineers, then I work with our UXers day in and day out on their discipline. And then I also work on what we call our developer experience, which is like the tools that our developers use to do their jobs, as well as like all the education programs that we have for our developers, our internship programs and things of that nature. So my day is typically spent doing on a variety of different topics. It's, you know, it's a lot of context switching. So with the UX team right now, we're really looking at how do we continue to, I mean, the discipline in the organization is fabulous, but you talk about interconnected retail, there's just so many moving parts. So how do we make sure we're truly interconnected as a UX discipline, and the left hand always knows what the right hand is doing and things of that nature. So spend a lot of time with the UX team, making sure that we've got our structure right to support all the initiatives that we have going on. I spend a lot of time with our merchandising team talking about, you know, obviously what's next. It's the aperture of what are we working on now and is it going okay? But then what do we need from an investment perspective to make sure that we're staying competitive, that we're staying ahead of things, and that we're not falling behind? And then same with the developer tools experience and all of our training programs. It's asking ourselves the same question we ask for our customers, like when we ask when we're doing our customer-backed design and trying to make sure that when our customers shop Home Depot, they've got a fabulous experience. We're trying to operate with the same mindset for our internal developers. What's their experience right now? What friction do they have when they come to work, you know, and come to write code for us? How can we make that easier? What tools do they need? You know, or what, like I said, do we need to automate or make easier for them? And so those are kind of the three functional areas I spend a lot of time with. But one of the other things I honestly do a lot during my day and during my, if you look at the week especially, is mentoring sessions and just what I call roundtables. So, you know, I host a few a month where you just sign up and it's a small group and we sit down and we have a conversation about how things are going, what's working great and what's not. And that's at all levels of the organization. And so those are probably what you would see if you spent a day with me, including, like, of course, some updates up. Yeah, I talked a lot about how I work with my team, but also, you know, obviously updating up on how things are going too.
You know, I think it's so important, you know, as leaders, VP of anything, that you are staying in touch with the needs of the humans that work with you, right? And developing humans is something I've just been touching on a lot, even within my own organization, of how important it is to just stay connected, especially through what we're all collectively experiencing in this new environment that we've all been thrust in, right? And our work lives have changed. Our relationships have changed. And business isn't business as usual. So we've had to redefine like what that looks like. So I love to hear that you're engaging in these roundtable discussions, which, you know, I think creates opportunities for more respect to happen.
I'll be honest with you, Lisa, pre the pandemic, like I did some, you know, maybe once a quarter or something like that. But now, like I said, it's probably once a week where I'm doing one. And And it's for the reasons you just said. Like, the world has evolved so much around us, and, you know, we've all, like, experienced a lot during the past 18 months. So to really understand what the human experience is at the time. Transparently, I started them right after the murder of George Floyd. We had so much hurt, and I could see our associates in so much pain, plus the pandemic, and trying to balance both. It was an opportunity to just get together and say, no, really, how are you doing? And what can we be doing? What have we tried that's worked? What have we tried that hasn't worked? How can we help more than we are right now? And it's really been, you talk about your leadership style and things of that nature. Man, if I had to do it over again, I would have spent a lot more time in this vein pre this time period. It's given me the opportunity to, and then you think about how things have just transpired since then. So we've gone through George Floyd together. We've gone through, you know, the social unrest after that. We went through the election, though we didn't talk about that very much collectively when we were all together. You know, we talked about just the strain of the environment. We talked about, you know, when there was an incident in Atlanta with some Asian hate crime. And so we, you know, we explored that together. And all of that, just to be able to say, yes, we work together day in and day out, but, you know, as humans, what can we do to support each other, both in a professional environment, you know, absolutely, in work, how can I make your lives easier? But our lives are bigger than just our work. So to recognize that and have the space for those conversations.
I appreciate that you said that so much. I mean, it is so true. Like, our lives are more than just our work, but we spend so much of our lives within work. So you recently launched a returnship program and are currently running your first cohort. So can you share more about that program with us, and how is it coming along so far?
Absolutely. So, you know, Home Depot, when you think about it, is a values-based company. And we don't say that lightly. We are very, in fact, my mouse pad, I could hold it up and show it to you right now. It's our values wheel. And part of that is about taking care of our associates and doing the right thing and having strong relationships. And it was really the spirit of this. We had started a program where we were educating people to onboard into technology. And then I think as you looked back over the past year and a half, we also really started thinking about the people that have had to step away from a career in technology, and how do we help them get back into a career in technology. And so this was an idea of who was a senior manager at the time in our organization. She had this idea of, could we start a returnship? We had some curriculum that was built from some of our onboarding programs and just the training that we do for our internal associates. And it was an idea that came from that we turned into reality. And of all the LinkedIn posts, et cetera, I've made, it's probably my favorite one to say, hey, we're launching this. And because I do know a number of people who have stepped away. Life happens. And, you know, technology then continues to change around us. And so to this program is really focused on a combination of, if you will, classroom, even though it's a virtual classroom type training, and mentorship and on the job training to help people catch up from whenever they stepped away to, you know, what the environment looks like today. And so it's going great. We're a few weeks, no, probably about a month now into the program. And I warned the team running it. I was like, I am going to be up in your business, because I am just so interested in this, you know, how we turn this into a successful program for these associates and how we cultivate this opportunity. And I want to make sure that we're successful at that. So far, so good. It's early days. Everybody knows, like I said, we're very vested in it. And I hope if we talk again in a year or so, I'm telling you about how much we've grown it. It's just really a phenomenal, phenomenal experience.
Well, now, Angie, I'm going to be up in your business because I will follow back up with you. We're going to take a break for today's Pioneering Women segment.
Today's Pioneering Woman is Sarah Blakely. Sarah Blakely is an American businesswoman and philanthropist. Born in 1971 in Clearwater, Florida, Sarah Blakely graduated from Florida State University with a communications degree. Sarah worked as a door-to-door salesperson and didn't enjoy wearing pantyhose in the scorching Florida heat. She also disliked the appearance of the seamed foot while wearing open-toed shoes, but she appreciated the control top that eliminated panty lines and made her body appear firmer. Sarah grabbed scissors and cut off the feet of her pantyhose, and a million-dollar idea was born. At age 27, Sarah took the next 2 years and $5,000 in savings and developed the concept and patent for what would become Spanx. Sarah's underwear featured different-sized waistbands and inbuilt support and shaping. Neiman Marcus began carrying Spanx in their stores, and in 2000, Oprah Winfrey named Spanx on her list of favorite things, which catapulted her sales to $10 million. Spanx brand has grown to offer bras, maternity wear, and an entire line of physique-improving products. Sarah was named 90th Most Powerful Woman in the World by Forbes magazine in 2016. Thank you for your pioneering contributions, Sarah Blakely.
Hello, innovators. We are back with Angie Brown talking about humble beginnings and building a successful career in technology for the largest home improvement company in the nation. Angie, you shared that you were born and raised and still reside in Georgia. So what do you love most about your home state? And do you ever escape for other adventures?
on the escaping. So, you know, it's home. It absolutely is home. I had the opportunity to continue to see people that I went to college with decades ago, friends and family here, my parents, my brother, his entire family. They are still probably about 4 miles from the little house I grew up in. So, you know, I think I love the community. And it's a community built through decades, and that's just really hard to, you know, replace. And so, and it's a community that's also fostered, you know, by the work environment, like working in the same area, both my professional contacts and my personal contacts. It's great to have that sense of community, and definitely love that. As far as escaping, it's funny you ask. So when I was growing up, I would say that my vacations consisted simply of the only part of the world or the country I saw was the road between my parents' house and my grandparents' house. And that was really it.
And the grocery store.
And the grocery store, yeah. So I really do enjoy having the opportunity now to see more of the states, more of the world, and to have that opportunity with my children to travel. And so we have a couple of different rituals in our family, if you will. When the girls finish certain milestones of school, it's an excuse for me to get out with them one-on-one. And so they get to pick a location and we go away for a weekend, et cetera, like when they finish the lower school or middle school or things of that nature. And so, yes, I love to get out and I love to get out with them. And I love to get out with that community that I spoke of as well, like my friends, to travel with them. as much as I possibly can. I've got all these miles that haven't been used now for a year and a half, and I started booking some trips and look forward to making them happen.
I know. I got a notification from one of the airlines that's like, you have this many credits and you're about to lose them. I'm like, I am not losing that. I need to book by December 31st. So I'm gonna be joining you on those escape trips.
That's awesome.
So you're a wife. I know, mm-hmm. right? You're a wife and the mother of two daughters, and you have what you describe as too many animals in the household. So how do you create balance with work and family?
You know, I feel like it's becoming such a tagline that people say it's not about balance, it's about integration. But you know, I think more than anything, like, I try to give myself grace and I try to advocate for myself. It's the organization as a whole that I work for is very supportive about work-life balance. You know, and I can say there was a time where I couldn't have honestly told you that, like during my Home Depot career. So every company goes through different iterations, but now, you know, I do feel very genuine when I say that we understand and support the intentionality of having a good work-life balance. And so it's important for me that I also model that for the organization I have the opportunity to lead. Because if they don't see me stepping away, like sometimes they may feel like they shouldn't step away either. And so I'm intentional about taking my vacation and taking space and I also, when I say give myself grace, you know, the reality is we're a big company. And just like you said, there's always a lot going on. And I don't want to be so naive to not admit, of course, there are times where you've got a big deadline. You've got something urgent that crops up. You've got the late night. And so, yes, that happens. But it's almost like I keep a roster in my head or a scale in my head of, okay, absolutely. I know that, you know, I got to push hard, got to get XYZ done. It's going to be a crazy few days. So come Friday, I'm going to head out and I'm going to go pick up the girls from carpool. And so it's not about balance every single day, every single meal, every single, you know, hour. It's, I look at it on a bigger scale, and that's what I talk about from a grace perspective and advocating for yourself on the other side. Because yes, there will be times the right thing to do is, it's a crazy couple of days, and I want to be there for the company and I want to help them through those crazy couple of days. But I also know that their expectation is I take care of myself. So,
you know, there's so many golden nuggets in what you just shared, because it is so true that our team does emulate our leaders. So if we're in hustle mode and we're always in hustle mode and we continue to burn the midnight oil, so too will they. And I learned that the hard way. Literally, some of my team members have adopted bad habits from me because I was very much like that for years and years, and recently literally just stopped. I mean, I'm not the same leader I was a year ago, and certainly not 2 years ago. 2019, Lisa Mae looks different than the Lisa Mae today. And I notice, I mean, nothing has made me more aware than today when I'm looking at some of my team members who are just in hustle mode. And I'm like, what are you guys doing? But it's I'm like, that was me. And so they really do pay attention. And it's so important to create that that space. And I love the word grace. I mean, my dog's name is Gracie. Aww. Because, and I named her that specifically so that I can remember grace with myself, because there's days that I'll get it and there's days that I don't. And I love what you said earlier about just, it's not about balance per day, but it's, I mean, it really is about like the checks and balances across the whole. Like if you're going to push hard, give yourself a little, you know, a little treat afterwards. So I appreciate that so much. That's such great wisdom.
I love the saying, hold yourself to a standard of grace, not perfection. And I may not have it perfect, but, you know, I think that that's true in so many different ways that, like, you know, to look at it over the bigger picture. And what you were saying as far as modeling it and being a different leader today than you were previously, I had the exact same experience. And it really wasn't until I had a boss that, like, I was like, why is he leaving before I'm leaving? Like, you know, and then it, you know, but he was intentional about it. He was like, you know, the company doesn't expect me to be here like 80 hours a week. Like, you know, there's an expectation that like you're taking care of yourself. And so, yes, I'm going to be intentional about leaving on time to get home and eat dinner with my family. And you should too. And so then it was like, oh yeah, okay. So that is, you know, and it seems so minor, but it is really a big thing to model that and to see your leaders modeling that.
I love that. What are you most proud of within your career? And what is your hope for the future?
I think one of the things, and it may sound simple or it may sound, I don't know, not that novel of an idea, but I definitely have been part of some difficult initiatives, and, you know, anybody in their career has been. And when you think about technology, it doesn't always go right the first time. And that's one of the things that we all need to realize and not be disappointed by. But so when I've been on these initiatives that haven't gone right the first time, I think what I'm most proud of is I saw them through. Like, you know, I didn't give up. I was willing to say, okay, that didn't work. What could work, and try again and pivot and keep going. And one of the bigger ones as an example was that, like, I started when we first started talking about interconnected retail. So I want to be able to pay for something online and pick it up in the store. The platform that underpins that, I was with since its inception. When we first went up to talk about this, what seemed like crazy idea at the time, and could we have money to go build this thing? And along the way, there weren't other retailers out there in mass doing that concept. So we were on the early side of it, and we stubbed our toe a few times along the way. And so that given initiative was a huge, like, thing that I am proud of when I look back on. I'm proud of the team that I worked with day in and day out that, you know, that brought that across the finish line. But I'm also just proud of the larger lesson of, you know, the keep trying, you know, and it's, things may not go perfect the first time. That's not failure. Keep going. You can figure it out. And so those are some of the lessons that really stick out for me.
Isn't it interesting, like, when we think about advice or sharing tips, that we, for some reason, we think it has to be this most profound, like, life-changing, earth-shattering golden nugget. But really, it is that simplicity that, you know, when you distill it down to keep showing up, keep going, like, that is the golden nugget. That is the end all and be all to everything, is to keep going. Like, you will stub your toe. You're gonna fail. That's a part of the process. There is not any person standing in any sort of leadership seat that has not failed along the way. And I appreciate that you shared that.
Absolutely.
At Wonder Woman Tech, we believe that vulnerability is a strength. So can you share something with us that you've never shared with anyone before?
Oh my goodness. I am such an open book. You've really stumped me. Oh, it could be. All right, give me some ideas.
Okay, yeah, I'll give you. This happens a lot. So it could be a hidden fear. It could be a feeling or an excitement about a launch. It could be confessions of imposter syndrome. It can be I'm about to release a book. It could be anything along those ways. How you it could even be somebody shared their journey with mental health. We've had admissions of health problems. Like, we've had some really interesting things. We've had somebody talk about singing to interviewing themselves in the mirror as if they were Oprah. So, I mean, we've had the gamut of experiences.
You know, I do try to be a pretty open book, because, like you said, I think being vulnerable with people and admitting your fears or your challenges or your weaknesses, that's a sign of, that instills trust, that instills that human connection with people. So when it comes to my fears or weaknesses or things of that nature, you know, I probably may verge on oversharing, you know, with my team. But, you know, there's a couple of things in there that, as you were talking, resonate that I haven't talked about on a large scale. And, you know, one was related to my youngest child. You know, we had a pretty hefty health scare with her when I was pregnant, and we found out 2 years after she was born, we got released from all the doctors and things of that nature. And, you know, she demonstrated no abnormalities, but we had some pretty big scares along the way. And it was all related to something they saw on an ultrasound, and they didn't know if it was going to impact her or not. So for about 2 years of my life, I lived on kind of pins and needles on, was everything going to work out? Was she going to be okay, et cetera? You know, I didn't talk about that a lot at work because I just didn't want it to be a focus of conversation. And honestly, work was a little bit of an escape, you know, for me at the time. But I think the downside of not talking about it as much is also that whole analogy around you don't know the road people are on right now. So when I did start to open up some about it at work, when we got the okay and things like that, was probably when I felt some relief. And I felt like I had answers and I knew, like, you know, how things were going to turn out. And I remember I was confiding in a coworker of mine, and he said, "So that's why you were crazy." I was like, "Okay, fair. Like, I'll take that." So that's one thing that definitely comes to mind as you lay that out.
Well, you know, it's so interesting because I when you said overshare with your team, I'm like, yeah, that's me. You know, I've always been really open with my team, you know, more than the average bear, if you will. But during the pandemic, we were hit collectively with just so many things as a team and as an extension of the team. And I found that I reached a point where all I could do was share and be transparent so that my team could understand the internal sort of disruption that was happening because, you know, I ended up getting COVID. We ended up losing our social media director to cancer. We had, like, so many things that happened between last year and this year that weighed itself on me as a leader and as a human. And so I started opening up, even with our interns, to say, hey, guys, this is what's happening. And the interesting thing about it is that they rallied together and really, I mean, executed, if I dare say, even greater. I mean, the productivity levels were through the roof. And so I found that if I trust my team more with what's happening, we tend to rally together as an organization as a whole. So I think there's something to be said for that kind of strength.
I completely agree. You said that very well. I've talked some about the culture at Home Depot, and we talk about taking care of our associates. And, you know, one of the things that we have at the company is we actually have, like, an organization that
help support our employees in times of need. And so we can donate into that, and then those monies can go to individuals in their time of need. And but even outside of the ability to support each other financially, like whenever we have an associate that has a struggle, when there's trust there and that associate feels like they can open up, to the extent that they're comfortable with, it's amazing to see everybody rally around each other and have that sense of community. Because, I mean, I think you're right. As we are open and vulnerable with people about, you know, what we need help with or what's, you know, maybe not going well, it is wonderful to see that community then try to surround people and help them, you know, go forward. And I think that's a lesson for all of us, that we probably shouldn't be as hesitant to share on things like that, because there's a lot of people out there that always want to help.
That's so true. So as we look back on your life and accomplishments, would you take the easy road or the road less traveled, and why?
What would I do? In some ways, I feel like I have taken the easy road, and to date. And I'll explain what I mean by that. I shared I've probably been a little bit risk averse at times. You know, I did change my degree at the last minute. I jumped into a completely different space. I went in, I figured it out. But obviously, it's not like I've moved all around the world. It's not like I've pushed myself like into uncomfortable situations. And so it's interesting to think about the what ifs sometime. Yeah. Now, you know, when I sit here where I am today, I have loved having an environment for my children as well, that has, you know, felt stable and allowed them to go and explore different things. But at the same time, if it would be interesting to rewind the play, the tape, and choose the road less traveled and see what went down, if that had been the case. I never will forget, it was probably sage advice, but I wanted to open my own store so bad when I was young. Like, I wanted to open my own retail store, et cetera. And my parents were just like, no. Absolutely not. That is crazy. Like I said, probably sage advice. But that is one of those instances where, what if I would have tried, you know, even if it did fail? Again, it's okay if it failed. Like, but it's a very interesting question.
Where is sliding doors when we need it?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, I have absolutely loved hanging out with you today, Angie. And, you know, I think one of the most beautiful things that I get to see over and over is how beautiful our leaders who are at the helm of these Fortune 500 companies, how beautiful they actually are as humans. And it is inspiring to see that people like you are leading teams and creating those kinds of values inside of the organization. And so thank you for all you do, and I appreciate you.
It's been wonderful talking with you today, Lisa May. I've thoroughly enjoyed it as well. And thank you for all you're doing to bring these stories to life for everybody. It's wonderful to have the opportunity to share with you.
Thank you so much for being here, innovators. Make sure you give us a like and share the podcast with your network. We'll see you next week when we take on the world one more time.